Now,
if you're listening to this, I'm sorry, but you've just landed on the latest episode of They Came From the North, the decidedly Canadian podcast about films, filmmakers, the ones we like, the ones we hate, and the ones we watch anyway. I'm your host for the evening, John Mercer. With me, as usual, from Canada's sunny eastern coast, Mr. Steve Power.
Cannonball.
And from the cultured French Quarter, Mr. Gabriel Girard.
He's bound and down.
Loaded up and trucking?
I'm amazed how well he hit his accent then. Kind of like, you know, when Rod Stewart sings and you can't tell he's Scottish.
I'm sailing.
I learned to sing while listening to The Doors and Johnny Cash, so, you know.
Oh, there you go. Jerry Reed. Hey,
no, man, he's like Jean Reno in Godzilla doing the Elvis impersonation.
Thank you.
Our subject for the night is a man who not a lot of film watchers these days are familiar with, but for those of us who were there for the VHS and cable boom of the 1980s, a man who surely delivered some favorites. This would be former stuntman, one-time director, and sadly, longtime retiree before passing away in October of this year, Hal Needham.
Last year.
Oh, yes.
Did you buy a time machine?
I did buy a time machine. It's called Coors Beer.
Oh. Did you bring that across three state lines?
That's bootlegging.
That's bootlegging, son.
That means you dumb redneck. Hal Needham was born in Memphis, Tennessee, raised in Arkansas and Missouri, and served as a paratrooper during the Korean War. Spent a short amount of time as a billboard model for Viceroy Cigarettes. That's a great name for a cigarette brand.
Viceroy. Wow.
And
I can't hear that word without thinking of the Phantom Menace. I'm sorry.
And, of course, as with most cigarette billboard models, moved on to Hollywood to start a career as a stuntman.
This must have been the Mad Men era, was it?
Needham is, for those who followed the work of stuntmen of the time, is a little bit of a legend. He's credited with introducing the inflatable bag to absorb impact of stunt falls.
Ooh.
And in 1986, towards the end of his directing career, he shared a scientific and engineering award from the Motion Picture Academy for developing a camera car with a working crane.
Ooh.
In the 1960s, Needham was hired to be Burt Reynolds' stunt double on Gunsmoke, and the two soon became fast friends to the point that for about 12 years until the late 1970s, Needham was living in the guest house at Burt Reynolds' Florida home. He began to transition in the mid to late 70s to life behind the camera as a second unit director on Burt Reynolds' pictures White Lightning and The Longest Yard. Actually, that's early 70s, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I believe so. And it was during this time that he worked on his screenplay for Smoking the Bandit, which was filmed in 1977. Smoking the Bandit was, for lack of a better word, a phenomenon. To some people, it's remembered as fondly as Star Wars. And
well, second highest grossing film that year behind Star Wars, I think.
It was indeed.
And I'm sure if you lived in the American South, you probably saw it more than Star Wars. After Smoking the Bandit, second, let me bring up my thing. He followed that in 1978 with the stuntman story, Hooper. 1979 with the would you call the villain a cult classic?
If anybody knew about it, I would.
We'll call it the underappreciated.
Yeah. 1979 with The Villain and Death Car on the Freeway. Began the 1980s with the sequel to his smash hit, Smokey and the Bandit, with Smokey and the Bandit 2. And then followed that up with another Burt Reynolds car picture, The Cannonball Run. That was followed by the... I don't even know what to call it. The experience that was 1982's Megaforce. Licked his wounds from Megaforce, a movie that tanked so hard that the producer, Raymond Chow, decided that no more movies from his studio would begin with the letter M.
Wow.
Changed the name of the Jackie Chan vehicle, Meals on Wheels, to Wheels on Meals. No, I'm serious. I'm 100% serious.
I believe you. That is amazing.
He licked his wounds from Megaforce in 1983 with
Megaforce actually do really well on like video and cable though.
That's most of Needham's filmography actually.
Yeah,
outside of the Reynolds stuff.
Yeah.
Stroker Ace, 1983, another Burt Reynolds car picture.
Great movie.
Followed soon thereafter by the sequel to Cannonball Run.
Not so great movie.
No. Then in 1986 with Red, or as I like to call it, Footloose with BMX. And finally in 1987 with the rock and wrestling comedy Body Slam.
Those crazy Satanists are out there on their BMXs again.
Okay, did he actually say that?
Oh, I don't know.
No, there was a mean old man in Red who shakes his fist at Crew Jones whenever he rides his BMX across
the line. Crew Jones, you're just too red.
By the end of the movie, I doubted you, Crew Jones. I should have realized that you just dared to be red.
All that red's going to kill you, Crew Jones.
Keeps me warm at night. So, for those of you, if this is your first episode of They Came From the North, our usual MO is we do what we like to call the good, the bad, and the ugly. The good is, of course, a movie by the director that we absolutely love. We'll, you know, catch any time it's on TV, if we see it on Netflix, if we walk past our shelf and see it, it goes in the player. Bad is a movie that doesn't actually have to be bad, but is missing something or... misfired or did something we didn't like, and for that reason it's something we can enjoy, but you know, we'll show it to our friends and they're like, huh, yeah. And the ugly is just a misstep in that director's career. You know, something that's we can still like it, but
it's irredeemable.
Yeah, it's just
Like it in spite of ourselves. We like it because we're probably more than a little insane.
Yeah, we like it because I'm not sure about Gabriel's collection, but I know both myself and Steve have DVD and Blu-ray collections that go into the triple digits.
My collection has been my video collection, and this is serious. I am being very serious when I say this. My video collection has been known to wreak havoc upon the weak-minded.
God's Video Store, we call it.
Lovecraft may have written a story about my DVD collection at some point.
In very few places will you find Lawrence of Arabia and Street Fighter on the same shelf.
Very few places will you find The Godfather and the 1998 version of Godzilla in right next to each other.
Now, it's a bit of a unique situation on this week's episode. Normally I'd ask who wants to go first in revealing their pick for good. I believe, though, we've set a precedent, and this is the first week we've all agreed on the same movie.
Yes.
I believe so.
I think so.
So who wants to lead off in our celebration of the original Smokey and the Bandit?
I can. Yeah, sure. Why not? You know, Smokey and the Bandit, it is a road movie. It is a little bit of a caper film. It is at times hilariously funny. And it's actually got some pretty great warm character moments. It's, you know... As far as I'm concerned, it is the quintessential non-pretentious film snob 70s movie. You know, like all of us guys who came up in the 80s and 90s, and we all became movie buffs in our late teens or in our early 20s. Of course, we always go to movies like The Godfather or The French Connection or, you know, any number of big legendary 70s films that are critically acclaimed.
THX 1138,
Annie Hall, Apocalypse Now. You know, like there's a series of films that pretty much everybody goes to. Straw Dogs, you know, like there are these certain heralded classics of the 1970s, and these are heralded classics among film snobs. The general public, for the most part, has kind of pretty much ignored their existence from the 1970s right up to now. Smokey and the Bandit is kind of the opposite of that. Smokey and the Bandit is the antithesis of, you know, that film culture film from the 1970s. But it is immensely likable. You know, it is a kind of film that it's a crowd pleaser. It's a popular movie for a very damn good reason. I think Dan Mancini said it best. You know, you were looking at a United States that had just come out of the Vietnam War, was riding an all-time low. You know, public morale was rock bottom, and along comes this movie with a cool guy in a cowboy hat who happens to be one of the most popular actors of the era in a black Trans Am outracing the fuzz. And there's nothing more to it than that. You know, like it's...
Yeah.
It had no pretensions about it. But at the same time, it's amazingly well acted, amazingly well directed, and pretty damn well written. You know, you get some really great character moments there. I always go back to the scene, you know, where they've just gotten out of a chase and it was a particularly intense one. So, you know, things are running a little high and they stop to take a breather. And Sally Field and Burt Reynolds start to have their little chat. And, you know how it's going to end. You know, it ends with, you know, the bandit getting the girl kind of thing. But when the two of them have their little chat and she kind of tells them a little bit about herself, you know, and the two of them start talking back and forth about what they have in common. And it almost feels like dialogue out of like a Woody Allen movie or something like that. You know, it feels more honest and earnest. It feels like whether it was ad-libbed or whether Needham and whoever wrote it, it feels like spontaneous, natural dialogue. It doesn't feel like, you know, two characters in a road movie sitting down bantering, you know. It feels like a legit conversation, and you know, the whole, you ever take your hat off for anything, the way it ends, you know? And
Yeah.
Then she tells me, you know, take your hat off. And, I mean, Sally Field in this movie is absolutely phenomenal. She is beautiful in this movie.
Yes.
It's such an endearing flick for me.
And she's got great, great little legs.
She does. And of course, my favorite exchange in the entire movie. Well, you're small like a frog. You're kind of cute like a frog. And I'd like to jump you. Like, that is absolutely fantastic.
But it's also easily the most timeless of Needham's catalog, which the rest of his movies kind of suffer with whatever fad they were attached to, or just the, you know, the style or the look of the times, right? Like most of his stuff is painfully 80s.
Yeah, or even earlier, you know, like Cannonball Run, even for 1981, 82, Cannonball Run was made?
81.
That feels like a 70s movie. That feels dated for a time, you know? And I love Cannonball Run. I have a blast with Cannonball Run. We'll get to that later, I know. But it's a movie I grew up watching, you know? It's a movie I've been watching since I was 5 years old, you know?
Yeah, but, like, Smokey and the Bandit, which is... Like you described, it's a toast to the CB craze of the American highways of the 70s.
Yeah.
It lives, breathes, and conquers thanks to a breezy but believable story, solid performances by the supporting characters, who everybody brings their A-game.
Oh, yeah.
And just the absolute towering presence of Burt Reynolds.
Yep.
Who's got charisma firing on all cylinders.
Yeah.
The bandit's got this scoundrel swagger that makes us want to follow him wherever he goes. And yet he's got this easygoing, likable presence that makes us not care that the guy's a, you know, cocky, arrogant son of a bitch.
And it's like, in a way that I think the movie feels even a little bit old-fashioned, but that's what makes it work. I think even in 76, it was a little, you know, just some of the stuff that's going on. It feels a little old-fashioned, but so that's why it's not dated. Because it's relying on those, like, on those standards.
The old-fashionedness of Smokey and the Bandit's more of a they don't make them like they used to type of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's just one of those movies you can pop in any time, and it doesn't matter that it's the late 70s U.S. South. It doesn't, like, anyone can watch it. Anyone can enjoy it.
Yeah. But, in, like,
it could have been made, you know, it feels so timeless that it could have been made later to be a movie taking that place at that time, and you wouldn't notice because it, like, it doesn't try to be of its time, you know, it just wants to be a good action movie. And I was thinking about it, and I looked it up, and I'm like, the blockbuster was really new at this point. What, Jaws had come out, what, 2 years before?
Yeah, Jaws was 75, wasn't it?
75.
And this, Smokey is pretty much the template for Jerry Bruckheimer, you know?
Yeah.
For the movie that he the perfect movie that Bruckheimer would want to do is like a more explosive Smokey and the Bandit, you know? it just gave the rise to all these more kind of disposable but well-made movies, you know, that weren't James Bond.
Yeah.
The other thing, too, you're saying, you know, Bruckheimer would have made a more destructive Smokey. That's another thing I like about it. The stunts are, it's kind of like Landis is the Blues Brothers. The stunts are simple, yet they're absolutely jaw-dropping in their gleeful destruction. Like, just cars slam into each other at high speed. I mean, there's never, you know, a whole ton of crazy flips or it's unbelievable
it's
jumps.
Grounded. It's grounded. The movie, yeah. It's a grounded yeah. flick, you know?
It's grounded, yet it's awesome, you know, when one cop car slams into the back of the other and sends it into a river or Buford T. I can't believe none of us have brought up Buford T. Justice. One of the most towering movie villains of all.
I was just gonna say, he's one thing where it's the perfect example of the movie being both grounded and being cartoonish at the same time, because this character is a total caricature. And Gleason knows it, but he still plays it seriously. He still plays it as a character, you know.
Yep.
Yeah.
And I mean, if that movie were made today, like, I mean, number one, you're not living in PC-istan like the United States is right now. But I mean, it's overtly racist. It's overtly sexist. And all of it is just thrown out there. You know, I mean, yes, a lot of it is from Gleason, who by many accounts was not what I would call a splendid human being anyway. But like, he throws it out there with reckless abandon like this character would. You know, like, it's a natural line of thought for this aging Southern sheriff, you know?
And it gets to the point where not only do you want to see this guy get his comeuppance, but his comeuppance is just the fact that he will never, ever catch Bandit.
Yeah, his comeuppance is just that, you know what, you're an old fart who's running out of track, you know?
Yeah. Like,
it's I love
the whole bit with the oh God, the African American sheriff.
What is coming to?
On the radio, you sounded taller.
Yeah.
And what is it? He calls him boy when he first sees him. Hey, boy.
You tell
Who
me
are
where
you calling
I'm
boy.
And it's and this guy is like this is also the other sheriff is also a giant of a man. And
stuff like,
I mean, it's just. Smokey's one of those comedies, and it not only did it set the whole tone for, you know, lay the blueprint for Jerry Bruckheimer, I think it also laid the blueprint for stuff like Stripes and Ghostbusters and that breed of comedy from the 80s. It's got this magical feel-good effect of making you just want to hit play again as soon as the credits have rolled.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And it also Needham introduced the credits blooper reel.
Yep.
Which just made it look like they were having the most fun in the entire world when they were making this movie.
Yeah. I think it's a film that, you know, it people kind of, you know, they hear, oh, it's about a car chase through Texarkana. You know, it's about a bunch of guys bootlegging beer and police and chasing a black Trans Am. And they kind of roll their eyes and they're just like, oh, really? Come on, you know. And in many respects, there's just as much said in that movie about, you know, these aged showmanship characters, like, there's just as much said about, like, you know, Burt Reynolds' persona in the movie and Buford and his pursuit and all that kind of stuff. The character beats there and the commentary, like, the social commentary, is just as apt as it is in something like Vanishing Point. It's just a lot less, it's a lot less subtle about it, you know? It's a lot less, you know, it's not like, oh, check us out and how smart we are. It's more honest. It feels like a more honest film than something like Vanishing Point. And I mean, I love Vanishing Point. It's an amazing movie, but it's got that, you know, 70s art house feel all over it. I remember the first time me and you sat down and watched it, John, I was like, Jesus Christ, this is shot like a Terrence Malick film. You
know? Yeah. Like, yeah, I remember I had to show you the original poster there with all the spirally tie-dye effects, and you ain't never been on a ride like this, baby.
Yeah, and even like Easy Rider is the same kind of thing, you know? It's so pretentious when you're watching it about its, you know, its character aspirations and stuff. And Smokey is no less deep. It's just a lot more honest and obvious about it.
I'd rather watch Smokey 1,000 times than rewatch Easy Rider.
See, there you go, right?
Okay, you love Jack Nicholson.
I only watched the Jack Nicholson part.
But yeah, like there's like a Vanishing Point's got all that stuff with the snake charmers and everything.
Yeah.
And there's more said in the whole bit, you know, when Jerry Reed, who is another thing we haven't spoken about, we should have.
Yeah.
Because Snowman is amazing. Perfect.
Yeah.
Perfect buddy, right, in a buddy comedy.
Oh, he's a great straight man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Instead of just being like in today's day and age, it would be Larry the Cable Guy and, you know, Owen Wilson or something like this, you know? Larry the Cable Guy as the Snowman and Owen Wilson as the
Matthew
Bandit,
McConaughey,
right?
But that'd be too cool. That'd be a knock against McConaughey.
Yeah.
Because McConaughey is modern-day Burt Reynolds.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it would be just a shitty Southern comedy full of stereotypes and...
Dude, it'd be like that crappy remake they did of Dukes of Hazzard.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
But they've got this whole, you know, there's more said in the moment when Snowman tells them that... Oh God! What's the distance they got to do in the amount of time? He basically says it can't be done.
Yeah.
And a bandit.
Well, that's why we're doing it, son.
No, because or ain't no one ever done it. But that's because we ain't ever done it.
Yeah.
And it brings to mind like
these two guys who are also past their prime. Who?
Yeah.
You know, they never really get into it. Characters don't always talk about it, but you kind of get a feeling that the whole Bandit Snowman thing, they were legendary.
Yeah, and
these two guys, you know, time has passed them by, and they both, you know, Snowman is he's got his, what is Bandit called, a crappy job.
Yeah.
And he basically does random truck runs, and Bandit's working in a truck rodeo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, these two guys are just, they're past their prime, and it's, you know, they're it's one more shot at glory.
Yeah.
Right? And you know, if you want to really analyze it and stuff, just that scene where Snowman gets the crap beaten out of him in the bar, you know?
He goes outside with a twinkle in his eye and a smile. He runs over all their motorcycles.
But you feel so bad for him there, man.
And it also drives on, like, okay, the age of trucks is over. It's the age of motorcycles now, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, the truckers aren't cool anymore, you know? They're has-beens.
Yeah. Well, it's like one of the guys, when they throw him out, that's a big 10-4.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Yeah, and the guys are has-beens, and it's just, you know, it's one last shot, and just, I don't know, it's a Forger who'd be making fun of me, because it's the exact same feeling I get with DC Cab. That just when the credits roll, I just want to start it all over again.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't compare it to DC Cab, because like DC Cab has none of the character stuff, and
no, DC Cab is a
bad movie.
Yeah.
Fucking the best. I mean, it's a great movie, but it's not Smokey and the Bandit.
No, but okay, yeah, but it's the same thing as like say that and what's another movie that does it? Police Academy does that to me. One of those ones, you know. Yeah, what'd you say?
Twister for me.
Twister. Yeah. Yeah, just one of those things where, you know,
ding.
Yeah, the end is come, and you start the movie all over again.
Yeah, yeah. Great movie.
Yeah, it's a really fun flick. I mean, when you think about it, it's hard to hit that perfect balance of the action, of the character, of the banter, and, you know, very few movies do it as well as Smokey and the Bandit.
And in something that's a little bit sad when you look at 70% of the rest of Needham's work, he put all of himself into Smokey and the Bandit.
Mm-hmm.
This is, you know, this man is laid bare in this movie. This is, you know, this is an artist who just, you know, bled himself dry making this movie. And it's sad to say, like, I don't want to sound like a douche and say that, you know, there was nothing more to Hal Needham than this, but it's really rare when, you know, his very first movie is the absolute pinnacle.
Yeah. Well, maybe this and Hooper, because Hooper was really felt really more personal with all this
Hooper
stuff.
Hooper definitely did feel like more of a personal commentary on his own career.
Yeah.
And how he had kind of gotten out of the whole, you know, he wasn't a stuntman anymore. He was into, like, he had done the whole, well, he did racing for a while, I believe. He was trying to get, like, a land speed record on the go or something like
that. Well, that's when he retired in 1987. He spent years going back and attempting to do that again. This is, you know, as a man who lived for speed.
Yeah, but I think, you know, after so many close encounters and close calls and stuff like that, you see, I think a lot of the stuff with Reynolds' character and Hooper, like a lot of, like, the doctor's visit and the whole, you know, like, one more solid jolt could turn you into a quadriplegic and you got so much spinal damage and da-da-da. I think a lot of that is Needham's own experiences, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that drug stuff, you know? Like...
Yeah, the painkillers and stuff, yeah.
Well, he's one of the stunt. When he was a stuntman, they used to say he was uninsurable.
Yeah, yeah, because right? he do, you know.
Needham was the guy who, you know, the only way to do it was do it real.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So yeah, I'm pretty sure he transitioned to behind the camera because he couldn't do that anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. This is a guy who I'm pretty sure if he could have kept doing it, would have kept doing it.
And I think it. Like, I mean, it's in one respect, yeah, it's kind of sad to say that, like, even if you look at Hooper as really – Hooper probably is his most well-executed film. Like, I think it's probably – it's his most personal, and I think it's his most – like, it feels like it's most honest. And that's saying something, because Smokey feels pretty honest. You know, that feels like a pretty earnest and straight-up movie. It doesn't feel like there's a whole lot of Hollywood manipulation or production going on with Smokey and the Bandit. It feels like a pretty, like, earnest flick. But Hooper has that little bit more – it just feels like it's got a little bit more of a personal touch to it.
Yeah.
You know?
And what I always liked about Hooper, too, is you can really tell he and Reynolds were really tight, really close friends.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, you know, Reynolds disappears in Hooper again. I mean, this is a guy who – I'm not going to be a cynical jerk and say, you know, he played the same card all the time. But, I mean, Reynolds was charismatic as all fuck, and he knew it. Right?
Reynolds was the George Clooney of that generation. You know, you cast Burt Reynolds to play a particular type of role.
Yeah.
You know?
But, no, but, I mean, he knew that Hooper was Needham's story, so yep. He became Needham.
Yeah.
Right? And it's just this thing, this is, shows how much these two guys understood one another.
Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, like, I think, too, like, Smokey, because Reynolds got so huge around that time. Like, he had Deliverance, which was a massive hit. And then Smokey and the Bandit.
Longest Yard,
Smokey and the Bandit. I mean, he was the most popular star in Hollywood at this point, you know. And it's easy to be jaded and say, well, the whole reason Smokey and the Bandit was a blockbuster was because Burt Reynolds was the biggest actor in Hollywood at the time. But I don't really buy that either, you know. Like, I don't really consider... There's a reason certain actors become popular, and with Reynolds, it wasn't just because he was a draw, it was because he was a damn charismatic bastard. And laying all, you know, ifs, ands, or buts about him, you know, like the stories about his ego and all of this kind of stuff, laying all this aside, he was, when he wanted to be, he was a damn good actor too, man.
Yeah.
You know, like, I mean, he was fantastic in Deliverance, and Smokey and the Bandit, I mean, he owns that movie, right? And Hooper, much the same. But, I mean, again, like you say with Hooper, he's not just playing the same persona he played in Bandit. He's got – I mean, there's certain Burt Reynolds-isms, yes. But he is still – you know, he's playing a role, and he's doing a damn good job at it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that's about good on Smokey and the Bandit.
Yeah.
You know, closing with some musing on Hooper, which I'm glad we spoke about.
Yeah, we couldn't just ignore it. It's too good of a
– No.
So now we'll move on to our bads. Who'd like to go first here?
I think I'll go first for this one. I chose Cactus Jack, also known as the villain, which is, I mean, it's a really weird flick. I mean, this is it's basically a live Roadrunner cartoon.
That's a good way to look at it.
But with Kirk Douglas, of all people, being the coyote, and it's a really, really silly movie. It reminded me of, like, the Lucky Luke cartoons that I used to watch as a kid, but even more silly. I really had fun with it, but I just couldn't take Kirk Douglas in this kind of role. That's my main beef with it. Why, you know, cast this you know, idol actor to be the, you know, in the Jim Carrey role, basically.
It's like it boggles the mind to think that Kirk Douglas is playing Jim Carrey, and then you have Arnold Schwarzenegger being the handsome stranger in this movie. And that's another thing that's fun about the, that prove how this movie is just silly. He doesn't have a name. His character name is Handsome Stranger. That's his name. And he's just the bumbling hero. Each time he tries to do good, he actually fails. Like, oh, let me help you cross the road. I did it. And then he helps her cross the road. And she didn't want to cross the road. Or he stops horses who are running at full speed thinking they're wild. But no, they're going to fire. But,
it's such a wacky movie. I haven't seen that in... Man, it's been a long time.
but basically, I mean, that's what's good and bad about it, because, I mean, how much of a Roadrunner cartoon can you take, you know?
I guess that's it.
You can't really watch an hour and 30 minutes of this stuff and be continuously entertained. After a while of, you know, seeing Dynamite blow up in Kirk Douglas's face, you've had enough.
Did that end with, like, Douglas, like, go cartoon or something at the end of it or something like this? I can't even remember it.
I admit I didn't even finish it. Like, I was enjoying it, and I'm like, okay, this is kind of fun, but it was just, you know, too much. But I understand what he was trying to do, and it's difficult to make those kinds of gags work. You know, the only person who could really make those gags work was Leslie Nielsen.
Great Canadian.
Yeah, great Canadian. But yeah, I mean, this is a movie that, I mean, it's basically a Zaz movie before the time, but it doesn't have as much energy as it should either. It doesn't keep the pace up.
From what I can remember of it, I can remember it being kind of dry, I guess is the word.
Yeah. It's just like long stretches of stuff not happening, and then really, really silly stuff, especially with the American Indians. like they're watching Kirk Douglas, and they're like, oh, he's such a dumbass. But yeah, I mean, it's a pretty interesting curiosity. It's both an oddity in both Douglas's and Schwarzenegger's filmography.
I still can't believe Arnold Schwarzenegger was in this movie.
And they give him so much dialogue too. I was like, what the fuck? Like he tells this long story about his origin, about this beginning, and you have Arnold speaking for like 2-3 minutes straight. I'm like, why?
I'd say Needham probably just liked Arnold.
Yeah, probably. I mean,
Arnold's a pretty likable guy.
He's a likable guy.
He's the world's most excited 10-year-old.
and I mean, you've also got Anne Margaret in a décolletage, so it's all good.
Yeah, I'd watch it again for that.
But yeah, it's a fun, silly, forgettable movie that kind of drags and doesn't really work, because seriously, Kirk Douglas, I still don't get this casting choice.
I haven't, like, I got to track it down, because I have not seen it since, I would say definitely at least mid to late 80s since I've seen this movie. And I'd say when I saw it, I probably watched it just because Arnold Schwarzenegger was in it, not even realizing that it was a Hal Needham movie, you know, like... I'd say it was something I picked up off the movie shelf, saw Schwarzenegger's name on, and said, yeah, I'll watch that, you know?
And then you get your release in New York.
I have seen Hercules in
New York. It's a fine chariot, but where are the horses?
Anyway, bad.
Steve.
I don't remember what I said was my bad.
Stroker Ace, I think.
Oh, Stroker Ace, yes. Big time. And the only reason I said Stroker Ace is bad, because I freaking love Stroker Ace.
What's wrong with that?
I basically picked it as a bad just so I could talk about it. I pulled a McVeigh. I'm sorry, Mike.
I did the same with my bed. But Hal Needham's like, he's a very McVeigh-esque director.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's a very feel good type of fella.
Yeah, yeah.
A third beer.
Stroker Ace, basically, you know, it is essentially Smokey and the Bandit set at a stock car racetrack, you know, during the height of NASCAR's rise to popularity, you know? Or I can't even say the height, but the early days of its rise to popularity, when the sport was just on the cusp of breaking into the mainstream, you know? Early 80s, when people started to hear the name Richard Petty and actually knew who he was. But Stroker Ace, I mean, as a kid, I loved the racing sequences. I thought they were fantastic. But, I mean, I was one of these kids who was a total – like, I mean, from 4 years old, I was a total car freak. So I'd watch anything with a race car in it, you know. But I grew up with the movie. I enjoyed the movie. I retired my VHS collection and didn't see the movie for 6 or 7 years. I tracked down a DVD copy. I believe me and you watched it, didn't we, John?
No, I still haven't watched it with you.
Oh, okay.
I'm really upset about that. That was you and the late Mr. Green.
Oh, right on. But yeah, anyway, sat down and watched it on DVD after tracking down a copy on Amazon, and really freaking enjoyed it. Had a lot of fun. You know, it's not Smokey and the Bandit, no. But it's not Cannonball Run either. You know, it's not one of those movies that you have to have grown up with to enjoy. But, it's entertaining. Reynolds, again, plays Charming really, really, really well.
More of an asshole, though, in Stroker
Ace. Oh, Stroker Ace, he's a total asshole. He's more, you know, he's not the Bandit or Hooper in this one. He's Burt Reynolds, you know. You also had Lonnie Anderson immediately before WKRP, I believe, or right around the same time as WKRP.
Yep.
Being very, very attractive. And you had Jim Nabors in a pretty cool little supporting role. I thought he was pretty good as Lugs Harvey, Burt Reynolds, like, team mechanic kind of thing, right?
The hairy hog of the story.
Yeah, yeah. But it was an entertaining little flick. I mean, the story unfolds pretty well. Some great racing sequences. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't meander much. It doesn't really slow down a whole lot. But it's brief. It's, you know, 90 minutes of laughs and a bit of fun, and then it's over. But
I kind of like some of it kind of deals with the whole NASCAR was starting to become more of a team sport. You know, it was starting to be the fact that they're stock cars, right? They're built to run the same, but you know, you're not just going up against a driver; you're going up against his pit crew too.
Yeah,
Burt was the very old school NASCAR driver. You know, if he couldn't win by racing, he'd win by smashing.
Well, you see the really cool opening with the bootlegging and stuff like that. You know, like his father was a bootlegger and all of this kind of stuff. And
kind of makes me want to watch. What was the Jeff Bridges one called? The Last American Hero. I think.
Yeah, that was an awesome movie, actually.
Yeah,
but it was. It has that same kind of vibe as Smokey, that, you know, that wistful, happy-go-lucky kind of filmmaking is going on, you know, and it's got an infectious kind of fun to it. You can tell everybody making it was having a lot of fun, and it really shows in the movie, you know?
Yeah.
For some reason, it's just making me think of Days of Thunder, the way you're talking about it.
No, it's actually Days of Thunder is NASCAR, our serious business.
You know, yeah.
Let's never joke about NASCAR. That day, whereas Stroker Race is like, we're just going to go race some cars and have some fun. You know, it's
you get a driver to a funeral, you'll have made history.
But
if anyone other than Robert Duvall had said that line, I would have just walked out of the theater.
You would have been cringed.
Eight years old, and I still would have walked out of the theater.
But yeah, you know, it's entertainment is all it is. And I mean, it's not entertainment in the same sense as Smokey and the Bandit, whereas Smokey and the Bandit, you know, like, Smokey and the Bandit was one of the first blockbusters, and it deserved to be. It's a well-made movie. Stroker Ace is basically the movie that everybody associates Smokey and the Bandit as being. You know, like, when you say Smokey and the Bandit and people roll their eyes and stuff, what they're really thinking of is
Stroker Ace. Smiles and curves.
Yeah, you're really thinking Stroker Ace.
But I remember that's what I used to have a book, a hardcover, like, coffee table book all about the movies of the 80s.
Yep.
Horribly written, but it was interesting when I was a teenager.
Yeah.
And that was the thing on it, was it opens up with the whole thing. You know, Burt Reynolds was the most bankable movie star in the world in 1980.
Yeah.
And then, you know, after a couple of years, when the whole formula of Burt and smiles and cars, and that. but, I mean, Stroker Ace is entirely that.
Yeah, and, I mean, Stroker Ace is that, and it's, again, you know, it's – you know, you had Hal and Burt getting together to make a movie, and I mean, as far as I'm concerned, you know, when the two of them got together to make a movie, it was a boys' club. You know, they had fun. And that was all it was about. And I think that the Smokey formula, as they kept repeating it, and I mean, it wasn't even that they were intentionally going back to the well to say, well, hey, if we do this movie, it'll be just as successful. I don't think it was anything so jaded as that. I think it was just that was their natural, that was their comfort zone, you know? And after Smokey and the Bandit, Smokey and the Bandit 2, and Cannonball Run, and all of that, you know, I think it's just by the time Stroker Ace came along, it had been diluted a little too much. And I think that's a lot more why the film is kind of not, I won't say not fondly remembered, but just not remembered in general, you know?
Guys, I'm going to ask if you wouldn't mind. Do you want to see if I just got a message from McVeigh?
Yeah.
If he wants to quickly jump in and join us?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, we can do that.
Yeah.
Let's have McVeigh jump in.
Just get him to quickly say his good, give it in. Okay, he's going to go. He's going to ask for 1 minute. I'll tell you what. I'll do my bad.
Yep.
Then we'll let Mike join. Let him quickly do his good and bad, and then we'll get on to our uglies.
Sounds good.
It sounds
okay.
Nice.
My bad is, and I kind of flip-flop between my bad and my ugly as this evening, but I had to go with my heart. My bad is Hal Needham's penultimate film, 1986's Red. Which, yeah, I love the laugh groan.
All right.
Like most of its brethren in the whole Teens Against Authority drama club of the 1980s, it built its entire fan base on VHS and cable. Possibly.
I still remember when that movie came out in theater, the ad was, like the poster, was all over Marvel Comics, man.
Oh, just
it's the close-up shot of the BMX helmet on the bike, and it's all like that washed-out pink and yellow colors.
And the totally awesome logo.
Yeah, it's like it's cut into it in flame.
Yeah, featuring a soundtrack, or the soundtrack featuring, because they were advertising the soundtrack as much as the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's a completely paint-by-numbers underdog story made barely notable by some incredible bike stunts and the BMX fad.
Yeah.
I'm getting the bads out of the way now. It's Footloose without a star, Rocky without a heart, or Karate Kid without a soul. You know, it
definitely is that formula.
It wheezes along from montage to montage until the end when the mean old grouch who shook his fist at that darn Crew Jones whippersnapper riding his bicycle over the lawn turns out to be a pretty swell guy with a soft spot for dreamers that have the guts to be rad. And the thrift store William Zabka villain turns out to be an athlete who's hungry for an actual rival who'll turn down a dirty victory if it means he can test himself against fair competition. I remember, I look back at it now, and I think I still groaned at it when I was like 8, when, you know, you'd sit down, you'd watch it, and I forget the guy's name, Bart Taylor, I think, was the BMX villain. When Bart Taylor won't, you know, he throws away the dirty win at Hell Trek so he and Crew can actually go head-to-head, and then Crew actually wins, and Bart gets fired, and Crew's like, you can come work with me. And they're like, high five, and everyone's like, super rad. You know, it's like the bulk of Needham's work post the Burt Reynolds boom in the early 80s. It's a formula of Coca-Cola, hair metal, and a never-say-die pretty boy who dares to dream big. you've seen it bigger, you've seen it better. I said Rocky, I said Footloose, I said Karate Kid. I can't help but fucking love this movie from watching it a dozen times in a single weekend when I was 6 or 7. Plus Hell Trek. You can't ask for more than the Hell Trek. You know, Rad is just, it's an anomaly. It is the 1980s.
Are you doing Rad right now?
Yeah, just get my bads out of the way. And it's just, you know, I can't turn the movie on and not hear Break the Ice start slowly as the screen fades in from black and just not have a mile-wide grin on my face, even though I know I'm in for 90 minutes of terrible melodrama. You know, you're going to trade away your future for that BMX bike? Of course he is, Mom. Stop being a square.
But why? Why wouldn't he?
Exactly. So he can do a fucking bodacious front flip on that bike over a giant football.
welcome to the table there, Mike.
Hey, thanks. Do you ever notice that Talia Shire is kind of like a Killjoy Gelfin in that movie? You know, from the Dark Crystal.
It's kind of weird, actually. I really noticed that in Rocky III when the opening starts, and they got the, you know, they do the whole ending from Rocky II. Yo, Adrian, you know, I did it. And her crying, saying I love you, and everything, and she's still kind of cute, Talia Shire. Yeah. And then it cuts to, like, 1982 when her hair – she's got her hair done a different way and she's trying to start looking like a sophisticated woman and not – what was her name in The Godfather? Connie?
Connie.
Yeah. Connie Corleone.
Yeah. And not – you know, she's not trying to look like a, you know, a Tiger Beat model anymore. And she starts to look like a Muppet. And, I mean, I like Talia Shire, but it's just she really does start to look like a Muppet. Yeah. And she's pretty grating in red. You know, you gotta let crew drones dream.
Yeah. So, Mike, we got our goods and bads out of the way. We'll give you a quick little recap here, not to dethrone this here podcast too much. But, John, give us a rundown.
Okay, so we all went crazy go nuts over Smoking the Bandit. It was unanimous. That was our good. I'm assuming it's your good as well.
I have not seen Smokey and the Bandit. It's not one of the three Hal Needham movies I've seen.
What? What?
Oh. Yeah, I know.
Sad trombone.
No,
wow.
It's fantastic, man. No, it's one of the early blockbusters. Totally deserves to be. I really like that classy Blu-ray that Universal released a couple years ago. They did the same type of job with Jaws.
Oh, the 100th anniversary, yeah.
Yeah, anyway, you know, it's kind of got the timeline of everything that came out that year and everything. It was a nice touch. I cried myself to sleep every night because Netflix Canada took it off.
Oh. I own two copies of it. I'm okay.
She'd be out in the kitchen, and then she'd say, "What are you watching?" Just hear the brrr, brrr. The beginning, just hear, "Oh, God."
Whenever Sarah asked me about... what I was watching on Netflix, like whenever I'd fire up Netflix and fire up a movie. She'll be like, "What are you watching tonight?" Bum, 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 bum. Oh, you're watching Streets of Fire again. Oh.
Well, you've got it. You got to get it because you never know when they're going to take it away.
No.
Right? You got to get it in you. Street, you know, and Streets of Fire and Smoking the Bandit are the same type of thing, you know, liquid gold.
Exactly.
Yeah. And our bads, Gabe went with the villain. What did you say was also known as Gabe?
Cactus Jack.
Which, you know, the most I got out of that conversation is while they were talking about it, I was smiling and thinking about Mick Foley. Steve chose Stroker Ace, which I believe was put very well when he said it's when people knock Smokey and the Bandit, the movie they're actually thinking of. Stroker Ace. The detractors of Smokey and the Bandit, you know, what they're thinking about Burton Cars and Smiles is actually Stroker Ace.
Yes.
Yeah. And I went with Red, which holds a very special place in my heart and is completely, you know, cowabunga awesome. despite that and me being an 8-year-old in a 32-year-old or 31-year-old's body who still dreams of kick flipping off of ramps and being rad every day. It's not a very good movie.
No, it's not.
We called it Footloose without a star, Rocky without a heart, Karate Kid without a soul. So if you want to quickly add in a good and a bad, Mike, we'll keep it kind of close and then we'll move into our uglies.
Yeah, for my good, I'm going to go with rad as well.
Your good is rad.
Yeah.
Wow.
Gotta break the ice.
Exactly. Thunder in your heart.
I really what's the song that plays when he takes what was her name from Full House? Lori Loughlin?
Uncle Becky.
Yeah, Aunt Becky, not Uncle Becky.
Uncle Becky.
You just be.
Well, those shoulder pads. Yes. Those shoulder pads really make her look like Uncle Becky.
No, when he takes Aunt Becky out, and lets her sit on the handlebars, the BMX, Talia Shire, and God, whoever played the villain, are sitting there watching the two of them. And
where babies come from?
And it's like a really awesome hair metal love ballad starts to play.
Well, the best villain in that movie is those twins. Oh, they're odious. Those
no, man, little... Ray Walston, who once again plays an old codger with a heart.
Totally 80s.
I always remembered it, but when I sat down to watch it the other day, I was like, oh, my God, that's Mr. Hand from Ridgemont.
Hold on, Mr. Hand. Right.
Doesn't it make this our time? So what do you like about Red?
That they live in a town populated entirely by eccentrics, eclectic people.
Much, you know, like the Goonies.
That hot dogs are three for a dollar at your local 7-Eleven. And apparently the movie sponsor is like 7-Eleven, I think, in the movie. And also Kix, Kid Tested, Mother Approved. There's like a huge Kix appearance. They have that like obnoxious high school preppy. Now that's one juvenile asshole. however he says it. Yeah, my favorite Martian is in it. My favorite Martian. He's Mr. Hand. The like mini Robert Goulet is in it.
Mini Robert Goulet.
Like, I'm telling you guys, timeless. Absolutely timeless.
Yeah. Well, I wish
I'd been courageous enough to pick it as my mode.
No, you don't.
Hell no, track. I really don't.
Hell track. Oh, hell track.
Hell track. It's the best. Sergeant Skinhead Smith. Oh, man. How about that guy? The bald, mustachioed moto popo. Chasing them around outmaneuvering the lumberyard.
when they introduce Bart Taylor at the qualifying race for Hell Track, yeah. And he's like, he's surrounded. He's got his stable of hose around him and everything. and he looks like Johnny from Karate Kid's dorky kid.
He totally is, man. Yeah, it was the thing. Was it in a predates Karate Kid? No, it postdates it. I'm sorry. Yeah, it's what, 86, something like that.
Yeah.
I think I saw it originally in like 89.
Mm-hmm. On Betamax.
There's that scary ginger that tells Crew's little sister Wesley that Bart Taylor's going to kick his butt. That scary redheaded kid. Find the ugliest kid.
He's a genetic mistake, man.
The reddest hair. That kid. The kid's too much.
He's a genetic mistake, just like Scott Farkas.
Scott Farkas.
Well, it turns out that biking is more radical than your education in this movie. Yeah, and there's,
well, you know, when you dare to be rad, you can win big.
Dude, this movie is crazy. I have it on mute right now. Like, you should see these outfits. I mean, these, like, jumpsuits that the twins are wearing. You know, Bart Taylor's wearing, like, this yellow tank top underneath a sport jacket with his, like, sleeves rolled up. You don't get more 80s than this movie. You really don't. Like, huge hair, zebra print dresses, scrunchies, berets.
Was anyone wearing Zubaz?
Zubaz.
Yeah, those, like, zebra print workout pants that were huge in the late 80s.
Oh, man. These guys act like such douches in this movie. It's insane. How can you not love Crew? You know? Aunt Becky.
What about your bad?
My bad? I'm going to go with the villain. I also saw that.
Yes.
Yeah. I like the... I like certain things, like, pop up in a few... I mean, this is – I'm sure, Gabe, you probably talked about how this is pretty much a Roadrunner cartoon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he used those words exactly. You've been listening, haven't you?
Yeah. I mean, it's not obvious at first because it doesn't really, like, kick in. I mean, it's kind of cartoony, but you're not really sure, like, how cartoony it's being, whether it's just goofy or what. You know, but by the start of the second act, I mean, like, they get into their – you know, like, it really follows the rules of Chuck Jones, you know. Like, there's like, anachronistic, like, it's got these, like, cartoonish slide whistles and sound effects and uses all these gags that are straight out of, Looney Tunes, you know? Like, there's, like, a paper mache boulder, you know, like, rolling down a hill. I'm sure you talked about, like, painting the tunnel onto a rock face. And then, like, they paint a tunnel onto a rock face, and Arnold Schwarzenegger is able to ride through it, and then Kirk Douglas, like, runs into it and, like, barely stops before getting – I mean, I actually like the villain because I laughed quite a few times very hard. Yeah. And that's why – I mean, it's a bad movie for sure, you know. But there's certain things about it that are really funny. Like, Arnold is amazing in it. It's really – you got to check it out for Arnold Schwarzenegger, you know, in this early appearance, like, wearing this amazing blue outfit. It's, like, this powder blue, skin tight – it's hilarious. It's just funny, and he's pretty funny in it, playing it straight. And
yeah, he's pretty good.
Yeah, you know, and Margaret's bosom also stars in this movie.
I mentioned that too.
And he's totally oblivious, and she's laying it on pretty thick, and she has like a new outfit in every scene. It makes no sense, but the rest of the movie's logic doesn't make sense either. It's kind of funny.
It's the kind of movie where somebody puts a ton of dynamite on top of a safe and the whole bank blows up, but the safe is safe. The safe is still okay.
Yeah. Like they do these like split screen double exposures where there's a cactus and on one side Kirk Douglas's head sticks out and on the other side is horse.
Yeah.
You know.
Whiskey.
Oh, yeah. There's like glue at the railroad crossing gag, you know, like, and he gets hit by a train. Kirk Douglas gets hit by a train in this movie. And the next scene he has got is like his boots back on.
But why Kirk Douglas, Mike? That's my main question in this movie.
Dude, he is so athletic in this movie. It's great. He's really, his slapstick's really good.
He's really good. It just, you know, I'm seeing, you know, Dynamite blow up in Spartacus's face.
Yeah. He's dressed all in black. He's got a mustache, you know, but he is like, he's really funny. There's one really great gag where he walks into a bar and he's just like all amped up and he walks right up to the bar and grabs a guy by the scruff of the neck and his balls and he just throws him out away from the bar. The guy must weigh 100 pounds and Kirk Douglas just throws him. No, like, it's not throwing a dummy. He's throwing like a man. Like, it's just to get a drink. And he starts punching everybody. It's ridiculous. You know, he's got his shirt off again, I noticed. Contractual. That must be contractual, you know. Has a glory. Every movie he's in, like, no shirt. Just strutting around there. But there's a lot of fun stunts in this movie. Like, a lot of really goofy, fun stunts. There's really unfunny, like, white Indian stereotypes.
Yeah. You know?
Movie that really kind of kill it for me. Every time they're on screen, there's these two characters, Anxious Beaver, haha, and Nervous Elk, and they like pretty much ruin it. It's really bad. It's not funny.
The pacing, like I said, the pacing of the movie is pretty bad. It's one of those movies that should be quick, you know, with the gags,
yeah.
And it just drags in between.
Yeah. Hey, but the horse in that movie is really great too. If you like,
yeah, it's really good.
Funny horse work. There's like a horse in the movie. The movie horse is Whiskey. I don't know if they used one horse. They say in the credits that they used one horse named like Ott or something. But then I looked online and the Internet Movie Database trivia said it was like done by like 14 different horses or something. So there's a Struthers Martin is in it, you know, for like a hot second. And there's, I think I haven't seen it, but there's definitely like Burt Reynolds' face on the side of a building too. There's like an in-joke at this brothel called the Pleasure Palace that like Arnold like inadvertently allows to be burnt down through ridiculousness. And I haven't seen any of these movies, but you guys would probably recognize it. Having unanimously agreed on good, now I gotta totally watch that. I'm using totally in reference to Rad.
And you need to go back. You need to listen to our thoughts on it too. And I guarantee you, after you hear them, you'll definitely want to watch it.
Well, now I kind of want to watch Rad.
No, you don't.
No. Oh no, Rad is really good. You know, I mean, Aunt Becky is super hot in her racing outfit. you know, which is like designed by the same like designers as Megaforce, apparently.
I think that's a good segue to our uglies.
I gotta ask Michael something first about Cactus Jack. Because I haven't seen the movie since probably the late 80s, maybe mid 80s.
Yeah.
Does Douglas go full on cartoon at the end of that movie?
Oh, yeah. I mean, not just full cartoon. They straight up use the Looney Tunes theme at the end.
Yeah. Like he gets kissed or something and does like.
Yep. And he's jumping up and down like, woohoo! Boom, 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 boom. Like up and down our roofs. You know, they set up trampolines so he can like bounce around. I mean, it's. You know, and what's really funny is that, at least in the movies that I've seen, there's always been characters who respond to, in the Hal Neo movies I've seen, like, characters are really into cartoons at some point. It's like a thing with him, you know.
Oh, it doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, and this is as close to, like, a Roadrunner and Coyote cartoon. I mean, it's definitely, like, it's weird that this is not Warner Brothers picture.
I mean, the closest I've ever seen a movie to be like this is Jim Carrey's The Mask, you know?
Right, exactly.
Or who framed Roger Rabbit or something?
Dropping his jaw.
No, Roger Rabbit is amazing.
I was going to say, you're not arguing that The Mask is good, are you?
No.
But it employs cartoon logic, and this movie is cartoon logic, and it features some really good casting. Kirk Douglas is great, and it's definitely worth it to watch Arnold Schwarzenegger because he's really funny every time he's on screen. It's really good casting. You know, it was a really good casting back in the day. He's speaking. It's not like he's dubbed either. It's like 1979. Like, you know, like it's pretty funny.
All right, so the uglies.
Oh, here we go.
No, we had a perfect segue there a couple seconds ago, so I'm just going to let Steve take it.
Okay, I need to make a declaration before I state my ugly. This movie is absolutely fucking terrible. Like, I don't... Whoa.
So sorry.
Someone turn off their razor.
No, that was my phone. I'm sorry.
Cars nowadays all look like electric razors.
Yeah, this movie is fucking terrible, and under no circumstances do I recommend anybody to seek it out and watch it. However, I fucking love it. I'm just going to say that right up front.
Because it's fucking amazing.
I fucking adore this movie, despite how terrible it is. And that is...
Makes the A-Team look like fucking Hamlet.
That is, of course, the... action classic, 1982's Megaforce.
Yes.
Do the theme music. Pew, pew, pew. Yeah! Megaforce!
Swish! We've long discussed Megaforce. Me and you and Woolrich sat down and watched it. Dobbin watched it with us too, didn't he?
Yes, he did.
And I believe we all had a very good time watching it as well.
That's where the Swish... The Swish joke came from.
I know.
Every time Megaforce is on screen, it's like, you know, nothing but net. I was checking at the beginning. They must have caught a scene out when the UN realized.
Standing there going, we need to hire Megaforce. Yeah! High five.
Yo, high five. And
a dolphin jumps up and high fives along with everybody else, and there's a big explosion in the back.
No, it's a dolphin jumps out of a tank and high fives a gorilla, and there's a big explosion. Some dude comes out and just starts wrestling a bear.
And, of course, it's just as soon as Megaforce is on the scene, it's just like, three-point line, whoosh, swish.
Yeah, it's like the bad guys who aren't developed in any way don't stand a chance.
Yeah, Megaforce just totally dunked on your third world nation.
It's not even as well written as episodes of G.I. Joe. Like, you
know, we're going to blow up the ocean!
Megaforce doesn't show up and, you know, Duke gets kidnapped. Or no, what was his name? Ace Hunter, wasn't it?
Ace Hunter.
Yeah, Ace doesn't get kidnapped.
Call him Hunter. Call him Hunter.
Yeah. Chico, you stole my lighter.
The girl doesn't get kidnapped.
Nope.
Chico at no point shows any menace. And he's played by a man who is made of menace. Henry Silva is a terrifying person.
No, he's the voice of Bane. Did you know that?
He was the voice of Bane. He's the guy that Burt Reynolds throws out of the world's tallest building at the time. Or not world's tallest building, sorry. It was the world's longest free fall in a stunt at the end of Sharky's Machine.
Yep.
He's the villain who introduced me to the term Colombian necktie. You know, Henry Silva, man was known for playing like Cuban and Colombian heavies. I don't know where he was actually from. I do know he was Latino.
Yeah, I know. He and Ace fought together back in the day. And
well, they started Megaforce.
Yeah, and he stole Ace's Megaforce lighter, or his airborne lighter, whatever it was. So that started a grudge match.
So this guy, Chico, shows up and, you know, starts ripping, like, helping evil armies overthrow oil-rich countries or whatever.
He's just kind of there.
But as soon as Ace shows up, it's just like, oh, man, I wish I was in Megaforce.
Well, I mean, even at the end of it, when, like, you know, they all fly away and he sees the flying tank, like the last shot of him, he's like, oh, Ace. You know what?
Yeah, and that should be another thing that needs to be brought up. The flying motorcycle at the end of this movie is
ridiculous.
The fucking coolest thing ever. You know, and the shot of all the guys, especially Swan from the Warriors.
Yeah.
And they're all there, like, cheering and everything.
Yeah! Come on!
I hear what the music is playing, because it sounds like a song by UFO. But they're just like, the music is pumping, and Ace is ripping off in the flying motorcycle, and he's getting away. Even though he was never in any danger. But
No. Well, they weren't even shooting at him. They were all sitting in army tanks, and they weren't even shooting.
And something else you need to bring up. Or I'm going to bring it up anyway.
Yeah, go ahead. It's a fucking terrible movie, man.
The dinner scene where he's taking them all on tour of Megaforce headquarters, can only be described as Thunder Mountain from Mask.
Seven levels of hell.
But no, the dinner sequence, his jumpsuit he's wearing cannot be described.
Oh, those
by
are
words.
Great. Yeah, with the neckerchiefs that they have.
Yeah, he's wearing what feels like a combination of one of Roger Moore's bell bottom James Bond tuxedos, and the speed suit from the Venture Brothers.
Yeah, they got those built in ascots there and those tight pants.
And doesn't he have a bandana tied around like one leg or something?
He's got more straps. He's got enough straps and pouches to make Rob Liefeld proud.
Barry Bostwick's afro with a bandana so powder blue that Jesse would have been like, dude.
And flowing. in like his glorious dry look hair.
And his beard. That beard, man.
His beard. Right.
A beard that would make Ellis from Die Hard just pale with envy.
A beard that would make Chuck Norris bend over and beg for buttermilk.
Chuck Norris. I want that contest. Oh, that's who you need to blame for Chuck Norris, by the way. It's Ben Stiller.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. No, Megaforce is – we need to make a word for it, like a combination of terrible and outstanding.
Megaforce is outstanding.
A portmanteau, if you will.
One thing about Megaforce, though, that is amazing and like, not even ironically, but actually legitimately pretty freaking cool – is those vehicles, man.
Yeah, and also, yeah, this movie came out right around the time when stuff like Transformers and G.I. Joe was starting to get really big.
Well, G.I. Joe was just kicking in. Transformers was still a few years out.
Yeah. But, yeah, you had, like, Megaforce had that, like, assault tank that used to change color. But,
yeah.
They had – I remember they explained the movie to some sort of paint on it, that when it when the sun went down, it like, the sandy desert camo kind of faded – to
dark black, yeah, and you had those cool black dune buggies, and there's some pretty cool vehicles in that movie.
Well, it's basically where G.I. Joe comes from, or at least the new age G.I. Joe comes from, right? I mean, like the 80s version, you know, of like action figures and all that. I mean,
G.I. Joe started the same year. G.I. Joe kind of
did it.
Yeah,
I mean, this is G.I. Joe the movie, basically,
essentially.
This is more G.I. Joe than G.I. Joe.
Oh, I don't think Chico would have caught it in Cobra.
No.
food.
Yeah, it lacks a strong villain. But I mean, the movie's it's pretty much a comedy and goofy. I don't think it takes itself too seriously.
No,
nothing Hal Needham does takes itself overly seriously.
Oh yeah,
which is not a knock against the guy either.
We also need to mention the 3D timer.
Oh man, the attack sequence.
Oh yeah,
that nighttime attack sequence where they start counting down from 5 minutes or whatever.
Yeah.
That sequence was actually pretty great though.
Yeah,
they're just blowing and stuff.
When the action starts rolling the movie, I mean, all it is a stunt video. It's dune buggies jumping over tanks, you know, fireball, like the fuel explosions erupting everywhere.
Yeah.
It's just the stunts in the movie are outstanding, but it's just outside of that, it's the silliest, totally
abysmal.
Yeah, silliest waste of time.
Again, it's one of those movies. I love it. I absolutely love it. But you have to bear in mind, the very first time I saw this movie, a coworker of my dad's owned a video store in like a little suburb of St. John's when I was a kid, and we went to his place for supper and. You know, the video store had been closed for the night or whatever. It was after supper and all this. The sun had gone down, and it was only a small little town. He was down in Portugal Cove. And, you know, he said, well, Steve, why don't you go downstairs and pick out a movie? And I was about 7 at the time, you know, maybe 8. And I walk downstairs, and I see the cover for Megaforce. And I was like, holy shit, that looks like one of the Hot Wheels dinkies I have at home. You know, like the weird six-wheel attack vehicle with the radar dish on top of it. I had the dinky, so I was like, wow, I didn't even know there was a movie of this. You know,
I will call you Dinkies the Movie.
So I brought it up, fired it up on the VCR, and I watched the shit out of it twice before we went home that night.
Deans, yeah, how old were you when you saw that?
I was like maybe 7 or 8.
I think that's the best age to enjoy that movie.
Yeah, but I freaking love that. You know?
Yeah, when your brain is still like, you're still in your formative years and you can absorb the sexist, patriarchal, condescending hero.
Yeah.
He's like,
don't you analyze me, goddammit.
he's so funny.
Oh, I still love, you know, she wants to go on the mission with him. She's like,
oh, V'ger, yeah.
No, man, all I can ever think of when I watch it is, didn't Conan bang a girl named Persis Kambada? But it's something we break out on Woolridge, one of the hosts of our sister podcast, Blast Processing. We break it on him all the time, doing Fury Eat Him. Ace's kissing the thumb thing.
Yeah, he hates that. He hates that so much.
And we do it all the time.
We always give him like the shit-eating grin right after we do it.
And he's like, it's always like, you son of a... And it's like, yeah, Megaforce, swish.
So it's pointing right at the person, kissing your thumb, and then giving them the thumbs up.
Yeah, accompanied with a shit-eating grin.
And a shit-eating, half smile. Like.
Yeah. Smug.
Yeah, you can't go for the full on Burt Reynolds smile. No, it's got to be different. Yeah. There's got to be a darkness that comes from being an airborne ranger and having your lighter stolen.
That's right.
So, Gabe, you're
back to the Chico. You stole my lighter.
Yeah, Chico, eat it.
And I still love that final shot of Silva, man, when he comes up out of he pops the button on the top of the tank and pops his head out. And
oh, the tank is also a smoking husk at this point.
He smiles and like nods his head like, oh, you guys.
Well, I'm pretty sure he saves him. Go, Ace.
Megaforce, you rapscallions, you.
Pew, pew. Hot and ready for you. Okay,
so yeah, Megaforce is terrible. Don't watch it.
Watch it. Watch it twice
in one night.
Gabe, you're ugly.
I have to go.
After listening to you, guys, I'm gonna go with Megaforce.
Yeah, no. Because I couldn't take a lot of it. I'm going to go with Cannonball Run, which is
Cannonball Run 2?
Yeah. No, because, well, I'm like, if the first one is shitty, the second one is probably even shittier, so I didn't even watch the second one.
I think I actually enjoyed the second one a little more.
But it's basically a shitty, it's a madman with mad world, like with really lowbrow comedy throughout, unfunny stereotypes, unfunny jokes, unfunny bits of comedy. You know, all these little segments that never adhere together to form a coherent story. There's some good little segments in there. I like the Roger Moore stuff that makes fun of James Bond. But I mean, Burt Reynolds doesn't work in this movie. His character is really annoying and obnoxious and not unlikable, and I mean you have my breaking point was they steal an ambulance, right, to do the race, because like a big part of the first part of the movie is him and his core, they're trying to find the perfect vehicle to do this illegal race across the Americas or whatever, and they decide on an ambulance because they won't get stopped at roadblocks, so they're like, oh, we have to find a doctor. And this guy finds like Jack Elam doing the biggest Igor impression you've ever seen, and he's a proctologist.
I thought Jack Elam was absolutely hilarious in this movie.
The scene when the cops actually open the back of the ambulance, and I mean, he spends the entire movie wasted on painkillers, and again, he sits there and he goes into full doctor mode.
Yeah.
Jack Elam is hilarious in this movie, but where I lost it was the proctologist. I'm like, anal jokes? Really? We're going into poop jokes now? I'm out of here, you know? Like, he just points the finger at everybody and makes them smell it. I'm like, ugh.
I gotta say, I do think that 2 was better in most respects. It's still a bit of a mess of casting and stuff. Like, there's so many people, and nobody really gets, you know, like.
Every single race team in the movie, it's all just.
Nobody gets enough screen time to.
No, it's all just the joke of what they're driving. You know, you got the two cyclists who are dressed as the newlywed couple. Only Buddy's partner, the guy who wants to dress the bride, is now so fat that they got to do the entire race in a wheelie.
Yeah, right?
I'm like. It's kind of sad that one of the things I enjoyed most about it was the Dean Martin, Sammy Davis Jr. pairing doing their usual shtick. Oh, and I'm like,
they were hilarious in it, man.
But I'm like, you know, it's still, you know, the shtick that they were doing years ago. And that's the funniest part, one of the funniest parts in this movie.
And yeah, it was the fact that they're both has-beens is what makes it funny.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm like, I can't be behind a movie that spends more time on Farrah Fawcett than on Adrian Barbeau, you know?
Yeah.
That's right. Adrian Barbeau was driving
the Lamborghini, wasn't she?
Yeah, she did the two chicks.
Yeah, but, you know, in the second one, it's Susan Anton and Catherine Bach. It's the chickie who played Daisy Duke in Dukes of Hazzard in Cannonball Run 2.
And didn't the second one also have Tony Danza driving a limousine with an orangutan up front?
Yes, he does.
But, like, in a way, this felt kind of like a Farrelly Brothers movie or something, you know?
What about Jamie Furr? You got to love Jamie Furr. The Sheik?
He was fantastic.
Yeah, he was fantastic,
absolutely fantastic.
But that's it. I mean, there's little bits and pieces, but I find that what they spend the most time of was the less funny stuff. You know, they're like, oh, Bert's a big star, so we have to give him more screen time. But that's one of the parts of the movie that I found didn't work so well.
I kind of I found it really funny when I was a kid. Now, I mean, you got to understand, I watched Cannonball Run when I was probably like 6.
Well, I mean, I've seen Cannonball Run since theater. Yeah, I saw Cannonball Run in theater.
Yeah, you guys remember like the big old ugly Warner Brothers clamshells?
Yeah.
Right, but you know, I used to find the Dom DeLuise Captain Chaos stuff hilarious, but now I watch it's painful.
Dom DeLuise is by far the worst part of that movie. I just, but and I that, generally that, don't that like Dom DeLuise.
No, that just kind of drags down the Burt Reynolds bits.
Yeah, exactly.
And the fact that they had to partner him up with a shtick instead of just, you know, making Burt, letting Burt be a you know, a scoundrel,
mm-hmm.
right? The Roger Moore stuff is awesome. And basically, best for the fact that he plays it completely just Moore's campy deadpan.
Yeah, yeah,
right. And it's, you know, that stuff there is fantastic. The it was kind of also a bit of an early showpiece for Jackie Chan.
Yeah.
Because Warner Brothers in the early 80s were, you know, everybody was still, you know, they were still obsessed with the fact of how much money Enter the Dragon had made. And everyone was looking for, you know, martial arts films were everyone thought they were going to be big money. So, you know, they were kind of trying to introduce Jackie Chan to American audiences. And
which is one of why they made him Japanese.
Japanese instead of Chinese. He was apparently incredibly pissed off over that.
Yeah.
Well, no, because he didn't know. I mean, they filmed his scenes. Every scene he's in is in Chinese, right? His character is still called Jackie.
Yeah.
Just like, you know, every one of them. I've got all the Police Story stuff downstairs. I got like a bunch of Dragon Dynasty DVDs, and in the American dubs, every one of his characters is named Jackie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's no, the bits with him, like, you know, there's a fight sequence at the end, and it's not that impressive now, but I mean, when you're a kid watching that was still pretty mind blowing. You know, the guy's like a monkey. And, I mean, they improved that in the second one by sticking him with Richard Kiel and letting Richard Kiel basically be Donkey Kong. But, no, Cannonball Run, it's a bit of a mishmash.
I enjoy Cannonball Run, but again, like, I grew up with it.
You also enjoy Megaforce.
Megaforce, I will freely admit, is absolute trash. However, I will say that Cannonball Run does have some redeeming qualities. You know, like, there are,
I mean, it's not as bad and as ugly as we had on past episodes, but and still, you know, that this movie was so popular and stuff when it's, you know, it's not really that good.
It's very much a product of its time.
Yeah, I still like a lot of the sight gags. I love, I believe the driver's name is Mad Dog. It's a pair of them in the monster truck.
Yeah.
And as soon as they start the race, you know, everyone leaves the motel and takes a right turn and starts going up the highway, and these guys just drive straight into the woods.
Yeah.
And I love the guys who've got their entire back seat loaded with beer.
Yeah. Yep. And aren't they in like a Challenger or Charger or something as well?
Yeah, they are. They're in a muscle car.
Yeah.
And they got the back of it is stripped out and loaded with beer.
It's a 76 Laguna and becomes a 76 Monte Carlo after they paint it. So they paint it, but it becomes a different car.
I kind of wish they'd actually paid a little more attention to that because there's the cool little bit at the beginning. I mean, the villain's a total milquetoast dweeb. But there's the bit, at the, you know, the. I wish they played it more in the fact that the guys all basically get burned. Where, you know, they go to the motel. This guy's at the motel, you know, basically identifies all of them.
Yeah.
And this is the whole point of the movie that they, you know, everyone's getting into, you know, trying to pull off gimmicks so they won't get pulled over. You know, you got the two guys in a Ferrari dressed as priests.
Yeah. Yeah.
What cop's gonna haul in a couple of priests?
Yeah.
And you got, you know, Bert driving the ambulance because it's not the fastest thing in the world, but.
Yeah, but they modify it right out, don't they? They like modify the engine and all that stuff in it.
Yeah, but they basically got it so it can't be pulled over.
Yeah, and that ambulance is the one they used in the movie is an actual. It's one they actually like Hal Needham and one of his buddies actually built.
Yeah,
so it's a beast. I don't know. I enjoyed the movie. You know, like I said, I think it's more. I consider it more of a bad than an ugly myself. But I mean, yeah. I mean, I can understand. I can totally. I mean, Gabriel watching it for the first time when he was brushing up on his Hal Needham homework for this podcast, I could definitely see you considering it an ugly, and I definitely don't slight you for that. Like, I mean, I sympathize and I kind of empathize, but I don't agree.
OJ, I'm saying you shouldn't have killed her, but I understand.
Now, Cannonball Run 2, like I said, that one. I like it a little more than the first one. It feels like more of a narrative than the first one. Like it feels like the first one just kind of ends. There's no real ending. There's no real ending to the first one. The second one
more ended up in the drink.
Yeah, but it's just never really. It doesn't ever go anywhere, you know. And all of the best stuff is early. And by the end of it, when it just becomes the mad dash for the finish line, and then the kung fu fight with Jackie Chan, it doesn't really go anywhere. The second one is more of a race, and I think a lot of the gags work better in the second one. Like I love Dom DeLuise and Burt Reynolds driving around as the army general and the private
in the nuke mobile.
Yeah. Like that stuff is great.
I also like the second one. Also, as stupid as it is kind of got the. Jamie Farr's character, if he doesn't win this, he shamed his father
by losing the first one.
His father's played by Ricardo Montalban.
Yeah,
and shamed by losing the first one. So if he doesn't win the second one, he loses his inheritance.
Mad stomach ulcer, so he hires the doctor from the first one to look after him.
And it's just the depths that he sinks to try to buy his way to the victory lane.
It's a pretty fun movie.
Yeah. Terrible, but fun.
Yeah.
What about you, Mike? What's your ugly?
I got to tell you, I've been watching Megaforce in the background. I'm at the scene right now where the movie is like predicting video games of the future. they're basically playing Tank Commander. The actress that played V'ger is like Tank Commander right now, but you don't get uglier than this movie.
That's your training simulator.
Yeah, it's pretty advanced.
If you say so.
I wonder if like the same guy that invents everything for them, they have like their own Q in this movie, and at their like special underground base, and this guy, I mean this guy invents everything. He invents all these missiles and stuff, and they have this like NSA, early NSA computer, you know, that like is able to tell you like computer, tell me this information. Computer spits it back out at you. It's such a dated movie, but
The computer's a less menacing whopper.
It's like a wall of just like switches, just blinking lights.
You haven't even met Duke yet.
No, not yet.
Just start skipping ahead. The first like half hour or 40 minutes of that movie is that utter horseshit anyway.
Yeah,
you're not missing anything.
Well, it's kind of funny how you'd be missing the amazing like little montage where they introduce Barry Bostwick. Like, I think that's like when the
when he's doing catwalks and shooting frisbees.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Beach balls flying all over the place, and like it's like apparently like. Their version of skeet shooting, except popping wheelies and firing Gatling guns out of your emergency. the movie is full of explosions. Like it opens up basically, they blow up this model factory with like Soviet tanks. There's explosions everywhere.
I can't wait. Next time we record Blast Process, I'm going to fight with Woolridge that this is better than Buckaroo Banzai.
It is better than Buckaroo Banzai.
Well, no. Buckaroo Banzai has the better supporting cast. You know, I mean, like all they got is like budget Michael Caine. You know, who's like only character trait is like complaining. You know who I'm talking about?
Dude, they got Swan from the Warriors. Megaforce ever get in trouble, he comes in with 120 hardcore soldiers plus loose affiliates.
Yeah, Dallas Bon Jovi. That dude is like the worst actor. He's terrible. He wears that skull t-shirt. He's kind of funny, like, but he's I don't know. I found him to be pretty annoying, but.
Buckaroo Banzai is fucking terrible. That's all there is to it.
Did we lose Gabe?
I think we did. There is a problem with this call.
Oh no.
Well, now it's about time for me to move on to my ugly.
Yeah.
Well, Gabe's not here to. Actually, no, I can't. Gabe's not going to say anything to defend this. My ugly, I went with 1987's Body Slam.
I don't think I've ever seen Body Slam.
It's the last movie of Needham's career. And
Hey.
Right, just moving on to my ugly, Gabe. We're about to describe 1987's Body Slam.
Awesome.
Okay, so first thing we got to get out of the way here. I like Body Slam.
According to Variety, Body Slam was a genuinely funny movie.
It's a send-up of the perfect storm of cocaine, pop music, and heavy lifting that caused the popularity explosion of pro wrestling in the mid to late 80s. I like that it's basically an R-rated comedy loading with supported roles and cameos by some of the legitimately huge, not under contract to Vince McMahon at the time of filming, wrestling stars of the 80s. I even begrudgingly like the sleazerific performance by Dirk Benedict as failed music promoter turned wrestling manager turned genius by way of fuck-up Harry Smilak. Wow. I do think the movie would have been better if the main character had been, you know, I just think Needham movies need a Burt Reynolds. You know, these light and breezy, and I mean, most of his stuff outside of like Hooper or, but I mean, most of his stuff is fairly, it's turn on, have a laugh, right?
Mm-hmm.
Feel good movies. And I really think that that character, instead of being just an unlikable twat, needed to be, again, a little bit charming. He's just, Benedict plays him as a shameless cock.
Wrestling?
Yeah, rock and wrestling.
Wow.
Don't you ever remember Hulk Hogan and Cyndi Lauper? And, I mean, basically what happens in the movie is Benedict is a horrible music promoter pushing a band called Kick. You know, this crappy hair metal act. And he gets involved with a wrestling tag team and manages them to a couple of matches. And then starts, you know, he does music shows sometimes. He does wrestling shows sometimes. And then he accidentally double books one night at the same arena. And Rock and Wrestling is born. It's actually pretty terrible. You know, I probably might have liked the movie a bit more if they let, you know, they turned Roddy Piper's manic personality loose as the villain. Instead, he's kind of like this plain as oatmeal hero. I actually think if I'd been writing movies in the mid to late 80s, this would have been a Needham's rebirth as opposed to the capper to his career.
It's kind of funny because it's one of the better reviewed movies in Needham's career.
Well, no, because it's very much of the Police Academy and everything style vein. What is that breathing noise I keep hearing?
Somebody's creaking.
I think Gabe's about to be attacked by us.
I was about to say Mike got to the part where the lady in Megaforce is wearing spandex or something.
The bugs can't fall away. they try to do stuff with it, and you know, there's a lot of like, there's some cool stuff, and especially if you were a wrestling fan from the 80s, you know, the villain's played by Captain Lou Albano.
Oh wow,
nice.
And he's managing a tag team called the Cannibals, who are actually like Samoan cannibals.
It sounds ridiculous.
It is completely ridiculous. But I really think if Needham had stuck to his formula a little bit, it would have been a better movie.
Okay.
You know, like the main character is just, he is very unlikable. Really, really sleazy. And he basically, you know, every bit of success he has in the movie is because he falls ass backwards into it.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, Roddy Piper's at his best when he's crazy. Like, totally crazy. And he's really, really bland in it. You know, it's not even like, I mean, I know They Live is a bad movie, but, you know, it's not even like that where he's got that little bit of charm. It's just he's a totally bland wrestling hero.
I didn't find him particularly endearing in They Live, to be honest with you, so, you know.
No.
Well, you better start eating that trash can. That's what our fight is going to be like.
Our
10 minutes of getting slammed into car hoods.
No, dude, it'll be over in about 5 seconds.
It's going to be two hits, me hitting you and you hitting 50,000 volts. As a curiosity from the decade of decadence, Body Slam is actually a little bit of fun. Held in comparison to any of its contemporaries, and by that I mean any comedy from the 80s, it whiffs hard.
Okay.
And it doesn't have Hell Track.
It doesn't have Hell Track, and it doesn't have Ace Hunter.
No, and I'm not saying this to knock Needham, but I mean, you could tell he was at the end of his career here and desperate for a hit, right?
Yeah.
But at this, you know, after this, he kind of hung it up. I really do think that if, you know, another director, I mean, even somebody like, Neil Israel or any of those guys from the 80s had done it, they might have done some more with it.
Apparently there was a lot of production issues, according to what I'm reading.
Yep.
There were fights with, like, the two lawyers who produced it or something.
Yeah, well, it was originally supposed to be released in theaters during 1986. I'm not going to say it was a hit, because if it was released in the summer 1986, it just would have been Aliens.
Yeah, Aliens destroyed Big Trouble in Little China and Transformers the movie. Thank you, Aliens, you fucker.
To hell with you, Aliens is awesome.
Not as awesome as Big Trouble in Little China, baby.
But, yeah, oh, there you go. If Harry had been played by Kurt Russell.
There we go. And if Body Slam had been directed by John Carpenter?
Yeah. It would have been amazing. Yeah, but it was like it came out direct-to-video in 87 and was just very, very swiftly forgotten.
I had never heard of it, I'll be honest.
But, I mean, it just – I only saw it there about maybe a year ago. I was just looking into, you know, had the Needham stuff on Wikipedia. This is before he took a turn for the worse with his sickness.
Yeah.
And I just looked at it. I was like, man, you know, Needham did pretty good with the whole trucker craze.
Yeah.
You know, wrestling in 87 was a legitimate phenomenon.
It was, yeah.
Yeah, and I just, you know, him doing that as a comic, I said, yeah, that could actually be pretty good. And then it starts and just, it takes way too long building to anything, and then it just, you know, kind of shambles into the end.
Ah, very good.
And Dirk Benedict sucks.
Oh. I love Dirk Benedict.
No, he doesn't like... I don't mean Dirk Benedict sucks. I mean, in this movie, he sucks.
Oh, okay, fair enough. All right, okay. I can't vouch for this movie.
And Dirk Benedict's a guy who is... you know, you've seen him play both sleazy and charming at the same time. He forgets to be charming in this movie.
Leonard Maltin said he was charming.
Leonard Maltin's an idiot.
Yes.
I was going to say Leonard Maltin also said, but I can't remember anything else Leonard Maltin said.
I really do love going to movie theaters. I bet he said that more than once.
It's 4 stars.
So, Hal Needham, do we have parting thoughts on Hal Needham?
I think, you know, he was a guy with a genuine love for making movies and fun doing it. I think his strength, though, wasn't necessarily as a director. You know, he was too much of a, like, let's just have fun to be a true director. You know, he didn't put as much thought and stuff as maybe he should have to have a great career. But I mean, he did lay the template for the summer fun summer blockbuster, and he was a good director of actors. I mean, generally his movies are well acted, even the really stupid ones. You can see the actors giving their all and really trying hard. And even the ones that are really bad, I find are generally, you know, they're well made. They're not like really shoddily producted, they're just, you know, product of their times, and it's the effects or whatever, but in the way that the movie's made, it's actually pretty respectable. But I mean, besides Smokey and the Bandit and Hooper, I can't really see him having much of a legacy, except for, you know, somebody who just like to have fun.
Yeah,
For being like Burt Reynolds' buddy.
Yeah.
I'll say, you know, he came out really, really strong. I think Smokey and the Bandit and Hooper are – I mean, we talked about it earlier with Smokey and the Bandit. I mean, and just to reiterate, and just for Mike's benefit more than anything, Smokey and the Bandit is, again, you know, like we – all of us film snobs, we've got our opinions on the movies of the 70s and what were the real classics and all of that kind of stuff. And everybody's quick to bring up, you know, The Godfather or The Conversation or Annie Hall or any of these, you know, artsy – you know, movies that film goers and film people really enjoy. But when you talk to the general public, these aren't the movies they remember. They remember Jaws. They remember Star Wars. You know, they remember Smokey and the Bandit. And there's a reason for it. I mean, it's an amazingly well put together movie. Amazing. It's beautifully shot. Really, really well shot. It's not stylishly fancy. You know, it's not one of these... Like I said earlier, you know, watching Vanishing Point, and it's like, wow, this is shot like a Terrence Malick movie. It's, you know, it's not textbook style, but it's shot perfectly. You know, like there's not a shot wasted in Smokey and the Bandit.
Well, you can definitely tell this guy had spent a lot of time on behind the scenes. You know, it feels like a journeyman project. Like,
yeah, and I mean, and it feels textbook. You know, like he knew what he was doing. But on top of that, Smokey and the Bandit is just such a well realized movie, such a well written, charming, intelligently presented. Even if, you know, the subject matter is not the most intelligent in the world. Like all of these, you know, the yokel Southern jokes and all of that kind of stuff, like all the stuff you would stereotypically think would be Smokey and the Bandit actually isn't, you know?
No, that's live and let die.
Yeah. It's not a hokey film. It's not a dated film. You know, it's a genuine heart, like well executed and heartwarming piece of entertainment. And it's, you know, it's infinitely accessible. I mean, I could sit down and show that to my kid, no problem, and I'm sure they'd have a blast with it, you know? But it's just a good all-around, well-made film. And Hooper is, again, I mean, you know, you get a lot of the same qualities that you had in Smokey and the Bandit, but you've also got a story that feels a little bit more personal for Hal. And, I mean, like, those two movies, he really did, you know, they were personal movies for him. They were, you know, they were... him and his buddy Burt Reynolds going out and earnestly trying to make a go at making films, you know, at really putting together good films. After that, I mean, I'm not going to slight the guy for having a bit of fun, but
no.
Nothing he did really lived up to those first two movies, mm-hmm. You know. Like the sequels and stuff. I think it's just, you know, I don't think he did sequels to commercially cash out or anything like that. I think he did sequels because he thought, man, we had so much fun doing this. You know, like, hey, you know, everybody wants to see Smokey and the Bandit 2. Everybody's asking when we're going to do another one. Hey, Bert, you and I had a laugh doing Smokey and the Bandit. Let's do another one. You know, like, I think it had more to do with that than any, you know, dickish, dark, you know, capitalist, you know, motivation or anything. I think it was done genuinely out of heart. And I think that's one thing that Needham was never short of, even later in his years, was heart and soul. I think everything he did for the joy of doing it and nothing.
Yeah.
You know?
I honestly think that's why he ducked out, man, at the end of the 80s.
Yeah.
Was after, you know, by the time that he took 2 years off after Cannonball Run 2 before he made Rad, and then immediately after Rad was Body Slam.
Yeah.
I think after that point, it was once, you know, the pressure was on to
capitalize, to be commercial.
To capitalize and to... Yeah. And he realized that's not what he wanted in a career anymore.
Yeah, and I mean,
no, he'd had his fun, he'd made his money,
and I think you can tell that Rad, Body Slam, and Megaforce, like those three movies in particular, he was a hired gun. You know, he didn't develop those properties. He was hired to shoot a film.
Well, he has a screenwriting credit on Megaforce.
Oh yeah,
he you know.
Page
46, Doom Buggy jumps tank.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Rockets fire.
And I mean, it could be a situation similar to Body Slam, too, where, like, once they get in and started shooting, he just started rewriting like crazy to make it all work, you know? Yeah. And apparently that was where all the stuff came from in Body Slam, was these guys had hired him to film this movie, and he basically rewrote half of it while he was shooting, you know? Yeah.
All those movies are so much fun to watch.
And they are. I mean, that's the thing. And it's an infectious fun, especially, you know, like me with my love of Megaforce and Cannonball Run. You know, I was young and I was impressionable when I watched those movies, and you could sense the like the feeling of fun going on in those movies, you know?
I was really surprised by the villain or Cactus Jack, you know? I mean, that I had a lot of fun watching that movie.
Yeah.
So, even though it dragged in parts, it was like – it was a ton of fun to watch that. And just to see the Kirk Douglas just camp it up and be like a cartoon, like basically the coyote. And yeah, that was – there's some good laughs in there. There's like some really funny falls and like – I think
that's another thing with him too. Like, as an actor working with Hal Needham, I think you needed to be two things. You needed to be unpretentious and you needed to be fearless.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I could see a real theatrical actor or one of these real, like, you know, art house style actors getting onto a Hal Needham set and just being like, you are out of your goddamn mind if you think I'm going to do this. You know, like I can't picture someone like, okay, say like instead of Kirk Douglas, picture Michael Douglas, you know, he'd never make that movie.
But see, the problem is I don't see Needham being a guy. Well, then you're fired, because whenever I'm thinking of Hal Needham, all I'm picturing in my head is Wooderson. I'm not running across those trucks while they're pulling apart. All right, man. We're an American band.
He's also contributed, like, or his films have contributed, like, some really great quotes, you know, like moviedom.
Yeah.
Like just in general. The Barry Bostwick quote, the Ace Hunter quote in Megaforce is so good they put it in twice. They put it in the post credit sequence too, which is like funny. It's like one of those Mystery Science Theater stingers, you know, after the credits. They actually they took out, you know, that part at the end of Megaforce where he like goes over to the Silva's tank and flips open the lid and he's like, the good guys always win, even in the 80s. And then, like, you watch these, like, credit sequences, and at least the movies that I had seen, like the later movies, like The Villain and Rad and Megaforce, they all have these stunt work montages during the end credits, the Smokey and the Bandit and
all the bloopers.
Yeah, exactly. That seems to be like a running thing with that guy. But he's got that other great quote that is from Rad. Remember the lumberyard?
I don't. I actually don't.
Oh, okay. Go balls out. You know, that's the cop's advice to crew. And that was just like – that's just like a great moment in movie-dom. I'm sure that there's going to be
– wow, that cop wasn't such a square either.
No, he wasn't.
There was a day when he was young when he dreamed of being red.
The cycle continues.
Yeah. All right. Any more thoughts, John, maybe?
No, I pretty much say what I thought. It's just, you know, once the end of his career came around and it stopped being fun, you know, he just didn't seem like the type of fellow who was going to – would stick around. And that's probably why he never did go back to it. You know, I'm sure – like, I don't think he was railroaded out or blacklisted or anything because of any flops. You know, the guy directed one of the biggest smash hits of a decade, right? And I'm sure he was probably offered stuff even in the early 90s.
Oh, you know he was. You know, like, he's one of those guys, once they disappear for, you know, 6 or 7 years, then people start kind of showing up at their door again. Because I think Tarantino actually tried to get him back out into the business again for a while.
Well, you know, they would have, like, offered speed to him if he was still around or something. For sure.
I mean, two things to sum up who Hal Needham was. Two great little things about him. When he started directing, you know, when he first started directing, he had some of the most financially successful action comedy movies in existence. And, critics trashed him, destroyed him, you know, they tore him apart. And, I love this story about him. When he began directing and critics were tearing apart his movies, he took out a full page ad in Variety. Which was, you know, the in thing to do was always to take out a full page ad in Variety. And the whole page was just black print or black a black page with all of the negative critical reviews about his movies, like all the different critical quotes, the negatives, and at the bottom of the page was a wheelbarrow full of money. Which I thought was absolutely fantastic. That pretty much sums him up.
All right. So next week we will discuss another director who has made a lot of fun movies and who also has a Looney Tunes connection. The director of Piranha and The Howling and Gremlins, Mr. Joe Dante.
Ooh, so that's going to be fun.
Cool.
I love The Howling.
The Howling?
Yeah,
I love
Gremlins. I said during our Landis episode that I consider The Howling superior to American Werewolf.
I'd agree with that. The Howling is the one.
Yes.
The Howling is the one I'm thinking of.
Yeah, with the hippie community or whatever.
The hippie community and the... this isn't a knock on Rick Baker, but just Rob Bottin had him completely whipped with the werewolf transformation.
Oh, yeah. That's for sure. That's still one of the greatest effects ever made.
Baker's whole thing was, you know, kind of like a fake arm up in front of the guy when he's watching the hand stretch out and everything. And Bottin's whole thing was jamming condoms under a latex mask on the actor's face so you could start to inflate pieces out of it outwards.
So that should be interesting.
Oh, dude, you don't even understand. So you better get ready for The Howling.
I guess all we got left to say then is
see you next Wednesday.